Mother's Day is this weekend, and coming up later in this edition of On Your Money, we'll talk about Mother's Day gifts. What's on your wish list or your shopping list? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's now 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 3rd. And also coming up on this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley will break down what the chair of the Federal Reserve Board had to say in a news conference last week about the future of the economy and what that means to you. We'll have some information on homeowners insurance. And as always, answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So do you have your gift for your wonderful mother yet?
I have a gift for my mother, yes. My mother is wonderful, and she probably is listening to the show, so she can critique it afterwards. I'm not going to reveal what it is, but we have something in mind.
Well, that is good. I did meet your mother, I think it was just about last year at this time, at a special broadcast we did from Eau Claire. And I have a picture of her somewhere. I think we should. I'm going to find that and put that up on Facebook.
I'd like a picture of her. That would be nice.
You could
send that along just so I can remember what she looks like.
Well, I know that you also were listening with great interest when Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Federal Reserve, held a news conference last week. I understand this was the first news conference ever by a chair of the Fed Reserve. What do you have to say?
Well, there are few individuals who are followed so closely as Ben Bernanke is. The Federal Reserve was founded by Congress in 1913, ostensibly to provide the nation with a safer, more flexible, and more stable monetary and financial system. And one of the Federal Reserve's duties is to conduct the nation's monetary policy by influencing the monetary and credit conditions in the economy in pursuit of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. And that all sounds very good. It's just a little harder to actually do it than it is to write it on the company's mission statement or the Reserve's mission statement on their website.
Yeah.
So Ben Bernanke is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And whenever he has these kinds of meetings or discussions between the Board of Governors or the president of the Federal Reserve, usually what just comes out is he just reads printed remarks and everyone is forced to parse through that. Well, for the first time in an effort ostensibly to bring more openness to the process, he actually had a press conference where he discussed not only QE2, quantitative easing 2, which is the Federal Reserve buying bonds to put dollars into the system, but also some of the goals of that program, what the outcomes were in his eyes, and what he sees going forward.
So what did he say anything that surprised you at all?
Nothing whatsoever. It was mostly what was expected. He said that there have been small improvements in the economy. He said, to use his words, it's moving at a moderate pace. Of course, except for housing and jobs, there are still somewhere around 3 or 4 million vacant homes right now, and unemployment, even as it's measured by the BLS, is close to 9% right now. He did say that he is ending QE2, meaning that this was scheduled to come to an end in June. The Federal Reserve is going to stop buying bonds and putting money into the system. But he said he is prepared to continue support and issue more money in the future if things don't get better. The good sign, I think, is that he used the word inflation 82 times in his remarks, and he only used the word deflation twice. So he was kind of giving a hint as to what he's more concerned about. He's more concerned about inflation than he is about deflation.
Wow. Yeah. You counted those.
It took forever. And then I had to double check because I'm technically a member of the media. I want to get it right. Then I said, oh, gee, I came up with 81 this time.
Right. Well, in your expert opinion, Kevin, what did you think of what he had to say?
Well, I think it's less important what he says than what he does. He says he believes in a strong and stable dollar. Well, the dollar has neither been strong nor stable. So if he really does believe that, he's not doing a very good job of maintaining that. If he keeps interest rates low for the foreseeable future, it will help temporarily prop up asset prices like stocks and bonds and commodities. And his hope is that this wealth effect will get people buying things, borrowing money to buy things, get the economy rolling again. The problem with that is that by adding dollars into the system, it weakens the dollar. And the reason you're seeing, I should say, one of the reasons you're seeing $4 a gallon gas and $4 a gallon milk is because the dollar is weaker, and therefore it takes more of them to buy specific products. Because that is increasing the cost of goods that producers use to make things, it leads to lower margins, which will eventually lead to lower profits and lower asset prices like stocks, bonds, which will reduce demand for commodities. So the longer that he lets this go, the more likely it is that it will not have the intended effect.
Everything sounds like it's lower except interest rates?
Yeah, interest rates may be raised at some point in the future. I don't know if the Federal Reserve will be doing the raising because they've said that they're going to keep an accommodating mood for an awful long time, but they might not be the ones who decide it finally. The rest of the world might decide that they're more worried about the United States paying off their debt than what they were originally concerned about, and may demand higher interest rates from the United States before they're willing to keep financing transactions by purchasing debt. Because there's going to be more debt, because the dollar is probably going to continue to fall, the Fed will eventually have no choice to raise interest rates at some point in the future or have them raised for them.
Well, Kevin, in summary, what's the takeaway from Bernanke had to say in terms of our personal finances?
Well, if you take the man at his word, and we really have no choice to do so based on these comments, but if you take the man at his word, you believe he's doing everything that he can within his power to try to boost the economy, to get hiring up, to ease the glut of housing. But there's only so much he can do. You can't lower interest rates down far enough to get people to buy homes that they either can't afford or just don't want. And with the more people see higher gas prices and milk prices, and they go to the supermarket and spend 10 or 20% more for the same items than they did just a few months ago, the more likely it is that they're not going to spend money, they're going to save it. There's something in his methods that say, if I just show people that prices are going to be higher somewhere down the road, they'll buy now rather than later. When they buy now, that will help increase the economy. But people don't actually behave that way, especially responsible people. They say, you know what, I'm just not going to buy at all rather than buying now.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Lori says, I am the power of attorney for my 94-year-old mother, who has an annuity that was bought over 30 years ago. And unfortunately, neither my mother nor I possess the original documents for it. Ideally, she would like to get a direct payment, but we are concerned about paying taxes on the entire amount. So I'm confused. Please help me, Kevin. Kevin, can you help her?
How many exclamation points did she use at
two.
The end of two? All right, that's just enough. She barely got in on the minimum exclamation points for urgency. This is an issue both specifically and broadly that many people are dealing with right now, not only long-held annuities, but also managing an older parent's assets and financial life. And so we're going to be covering these over the next few weeks. But for right now, generally how this works, if they did know how much was originally deposited and then they took the money out, they would only owe on the profits, meaning if they had put $20,000 into the annuity way back when and it was now worth $50,000 and it was all pulled out at once, they would only owe taxes on the $30,000 profit. And the way the rules work, if you can't prove to the IRS what you put into that annuity. Technically, you owe taxes on the entire amount, or at least the entire withdrawal is taxed as ordinary income.
Oh, so, well, how can she find out the original deposit amount?
I would be willing to bet it is somewhere. The question is, can she find it and obtain it? The information may even be on the statement. Sometimes these statements, when they're rolled over from one annuity to the other, are actually the original cost basis is on there. It's just very difficult to find. Many statements from financial services companies are, for some reason, difficult to read. She can also contact the current company and say, I don't see this information on the statement. Do you have any documents relating to the transfer? And then try to trace it backwards that way through each individual contract. Because in most cases, at some point, whenever the annuity was transferred from one company to another, there was a requirement that the original cost basis was put into the application document.
What happens if she can't come up with the original deposit amount?
Well, a couple things to keep in mind on this. First of all, someone was going to pay taxes on this money at some point, or at least the distributions were going to be taxable. Even if Lori's mother hadn't made it to 94 and beyond, if that money had been passed down, Lori or somebody else was going to pay taxes on it. The second thing is, they've been able to avoid that taxes on that for many, many years. So yes, it now has a big tax bill, but that money has been allowed to grow without being cut by taxes every single year. So that might make Lori and her mother feel better. Third thing is, she probably put a relatively small amount into this annuity if it was 30 years ago. So most of it would be taxed even if she knew the cost basis. Probably the smartest way to get it out of there with paying the least in tax possible is to just take a small amount every single month if she can help it. Let's say it's $50,000. Take $1,000 a month out for every single year for 48 months or for 4 years. And over that time, only the $12,000 a year will be added onto her taxable income rather than putting the whole amount onto 1 year's tax basis. Ideally, what she would like to do is keep the entire amount taxed below the 25% federal level, which is about $34,500 for individuals, and that generally can be found on line 43 of the 1040. So take a little bit out every single month rather than doing it all at one lump sum, and you should be able to cut your tax bill over time.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, here with us for another edition of On Your Money. And we will welcome your question about personal finances at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. I want to remind you that tomorrow at this time, it's One Day Wednesday. That's one day when we hope to raise a week's worth of pledges in just one day. And tomorrow at this time, the first spring foods are about to come in Wisconsin. We'll talk with my guest about what to do with asparagus, rhubarb, even dandelions tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Kevin, have you ever eaten dandelions?
Not intentionally, no.
They're good in salads, and they make good wine, too. We'll talk about...
When spring does begin, this will be a helpful topic to yes. have in mind.
I know. It's so cold. But we have many callers, so let me go to the phones. Bill in Racine is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Say, Kevin, we haven't laddered in the past, you know, with CDs trying to get... avoid what we're running into. You know, you've got some CDs coming due right now. So the question is, if interest rates, say, peak after 2 years, is that the end of the ladder? Then you would maybe get a six-month, one-year, one-and-a-half-year, whatever, and then a two-year?
You mean you're saying if you ladder your CDs out and you find that actually the yields are higher on the two-year CD than they are on the three- and four-year?
Where'd you go, Bill?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. In other words, where does the ladder end? I guess that's what I'm trying to get
at. At the top.
At the top. I like
it. Yeah, that's a good question. And typically, Laddering CDs, for people who aren't familiar with the concept, is when you take a group of CDs, and rather than buying just a short-term one and rolling it over or sticking your neck out longer, you split them up among intervals so that you have a certain amount coming due every single year, let's say. So if you had $50,000, you would put $10,000 into a CD coming due in a year, another 10 in the second year, et cetera. And then the nice thing about that is if interest rates rise, well, great, you've got money coming in that you can renew at that higher interest rate if the CD is the best thing for you at that time. But if interest rates fall, in theory anyway, the longer maturities have a higher yield locked in, and so therefore you're going to be able to benefit from that. Now, I would say, is the 2 year that you're seeing, Bill, is that some kind of spring bump up special or something, or is that just the way the rates happen to be?
No, to tell you the truth, I didn't really do any real checking. It just appeared to me watching some of these financial shows that, you know, you go out 2 years and it kind of seems to level off moving forward.
Yeah, generally what that is it's the marketplace anyway saying that that it thinks that interest rates will actually be lower in 3 or 4 years, and so they're going to give you a lower rate of return for that time. I would actually rather have you, all of the things being equal, take out the longest term CD that you can find and just make sure that the penalty for early withdrawal is relatively low, meaning 6 months to hopefully no more than a year's worth of interest if you should pull it out early. That means that you generally get a higher yield over a longer period of time. But if rates do happen to rise or you need the money, you can pull it out and the damage is relatively small and take it someplace else and get a higher interest rate or just use it for saving. That's actually the laddering's good and it's usually the simplest way to do it. But a better way to do it is usually to stick it out as far as you can get it because we don't know. Interest rates may go down in the future.
Okay. See, if you wanted to take a little more risk, do you have any other suggestions other than the CD?
In my opinion, most bonds right now, the risk is greater than the reward in most cases. Even if you're getting 6 or 7%, you're probably going to take a chance on losing 10 to 20% of the money. And if you do the math over the long term, 1 year of that kind of loss puts you right back down to the 2 or 3% that CDs offer.
Thank you very much, Bill, for the call and good luck. Fred in Wisconsin Rapids is with us now. Hi, Fred.
Hi, guys. First of all, if the economy doesn't improve, we'll all be eating dandelions. Eating my creeping Charlies.
I'll get some recipes for you.
I'm a couple weeks late on this, Kevin, but, you know, we have TV. Everybody has TV commercials that bug them. Well, what bugs me is, I don't know if you ever watch these commercials where these firms are advertising, if you have IRS problems, they're going to save you a bundle. And then they have people trot on that I owned $1 million and I settled for $300,000. And it almost makes you want to not pay your taxes and just go for one of these firms and you know, only pay a third of what you own. And it used to be bad where you just listened to them right at tax time. But there's one commercial, Patrick Cox from Taxmasters, that he runs the commercials year-round. And I guess what I want to ask you to help people out in the audience, Kevin, do these firms really have a legitimate service, and do they, in fact, really save people money on their taxes?
I can't speak to the gentleman you mentioned. I don't believe generally that they can do that. The IRS is actually more forgiving than many people believe. There's not this, you know, this notion. There's this notion that people want. I think the IRS wants to confiscate every single penny you have. At tax time, it feels like that. But the IRS doesn't set the laws. They just enforce it. And if you don't like the tax laws, the IRS is not the people or the parties you should be angry with. It's Congress. And the IRS is actually just says, look, we just want you to pay what you owe. No more. Definitely no more. We'll give you a refund if you paid more than you owe. But we want you to pay everything that you do owe. That's our job, is to enforce and collect. These other people in the commercials, there's a woman named Ronnie Deutsch who's actually way more prevalent than this other gentleman you spoke of.
Oh, yeah,
she's actually in a lot of hot water because for several things that she's accused of, But it generally is for people who tax negotiation is really more about, look, I know I owe, but I just don't have the money. And even the IRS doesn't say, oh, well, we tried. Good luck next year. We hope things improve for you. They say, all right, you're going to pay us, and here's how you're going to pay us. And if you take as much time as you want, but we're going to ding you with penalties. We're going to collect any refunds you have coming. And we're really going to go after you hard, in part because they want people to know that they have to pay their taxes as part of a civilized society. I don't like paying taxes. Nobody does. But I understand that taxes at some level have a necessity and they're needed. So I generally, the good rule of thumb is if it's on after 10 o'clock, you should probably take it with a truckload of salt, and you should possibly question what programs you're watching. If, you know, I don't know if the Jerry Springer show is even on anymore, but that might be one where you've seen that.
So someone who owes $1 million in taxes is not going to get the IRS to agree to accept $500,000?
There have been histories of negotiating that, and usually it's involved, like any proposition, where, you know, the tax code is very gray, and especially on more esoteric matters like expenses of developing property, let's say, versus writing off expenses of income. And 99% of the people owe what they owe. It really is no better or worse. You can change your own personal situation, but trying to argue with the IRS that, you know, because there's gold fringe on the flag, you don't owe any taxes, that's spurious, and you can delay the inevitable, but eventually you'll get hit by it. So I just pay the taxes, be done with it, and move on.
And our next caller is Carmen in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Carmen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a CD with just over $250,000 coming due in 1 week, and I've been talking to a financial planner. I'm getting 1.4 on the interest on it. This financial planner wants me to put it into a Prudential account where I leave it there until I need it, and then I start drawing it on a monthly basis at 5%. Some of the benefits sound real good. I mean, there's a beneficiary factor, and he says that I can, if I need the money, I can cancel out of the contract at any time. I'm wondering if there's a better idea than what I just explained to you, or if you need to know something else, I'll tell you.
Could you read the prospectus to us, please?
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's what I said. That's what I said to him. Something to that effect. Yeah. I mean, it sounds almost too good to be true.
This is an annuity we're talking about, isn't it, Kevin?
You're right, Joy.
Yeah.
It's really just a matter of time before you take this show over, isn't it? You've actually listened enough that you know I really only have four things that I say, and I just kind of throw a joke in here and there and try to make a show out of it. So, yeah, I realize I better come up with something.
I just heard a Prudential account, and that was my clue.
Yep, and annuities in and of themselves are not bad, and in many cases they can be very good. They have many features and benefits that are not available in many other types of investments. The problem is that you pay expenses for those features and benefits, and annuities in general pay the greatest amount of commission as a percentage of your deposit, more so than just about any other type of common investment. Consequently, some people, I'm not saying this is your guy, Carmen, but some people miss some of the downfall of annuities or the drawbacks in an effort to promote the sale of it so that they can get a higher level of commission. One of the problems I have with annuities is actually that many of the benefits are highlighted, but the drawbacks are not. Now, has your person talked with you about surrender charges? If you do pull the money out of the annuity, what you're going to pay?
Yeah, he said there'd be no penalty if I canceled the account out. And I talked to somebody else that wanted to give me 8%, but, you know, no beneficiary clause. They own the money once I sign it over. So if I draw 1 month and die, that money's gone. I did talk to him about the surrender deal, and he said any time at no penalty, I can cancel the account out. I didn't ask him if I could take part of the money out, but I was going to ask him to, you know, write what we've been talking about instead of just giving me a booklet of page after page after page of stuff. I was going to ask him to write what he's telling me about about it in the contract before I sign. You understand what I'm
saying? Yeah, but better than that, Carmen, just to have him show you. First of all, I'd skip the 8% person. I don't even know what the story is in there, but I don't like it.
Okay.
Second of all, have the person talking, promoting the other annuity, show you in that big book where it says, I can pull this money out whenever I want with no penalty whatsoever. That could be true. Some annuities do have no surrender charge ongoing, but they have higher annual expenses. The best way to target what your expenses are is ask the person servicing the account or trying to sell you the annuity, how do you get paid and what are you going to make off of this? Because that's going to come out of your pocket one way or other. He can say, oh, well, the insurance company pays me. Well, the insurance company has to make it then off of you so that they can pay him. And that's where people really get into trouble for this. My guess is that with all the benefits that this account might offer, it's probably not something that you really need because you are used to living off of CDs and you don't need growth. You need to more preservation of principal. Is that correct?
I don't know. I've been disabled for 12 years. I haven't been able to work. I hardly got any money from the settlement where I got rear-ended by a semi. And so growth would increase the monthly payment and when I started drawing, and then he says that payment could go up depending on what the investments of mine do, but it would never go down after I start drawing.
Does this sum you're discussing represent the lion's share of your liquid assets?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I probably got $250,000 worth of classic cars. I'll probably have to sell some of those. I told my parents when I was in my 20s I'd never let them go live in a nursing home. I mean, and my mom's going to be 90 June 1st. I mean, I'm living with her. I'm going to have to take over the expenses and the taxes of the house and, you know, and the upkeep and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
When she passes away, so I don't.
Well, here's what I would say: rather than putting all of this, if you get all the way through the annuity and the discussion, and this gentleman shows you everything in the prospectus that backs up what he's purporting to, which certainly could be true, and you still want to put money into it, why don't you put a little bit in it? Put in $50,000 rather than $250,000, and then roll the rest into the CDs. And if it turns out to be the greatest thing in the world, you still have a good chunk of money invested in it. But if not, you still have other money that's perfectly safe, perfectly sound. You can get at it whenever you want, and you don't have to worry about risking it or fees or expenses or complexity. How's that sound?
Well, it sounds okay. I kind of like the idea of getting 5%. Instead, it's going to go back to under 1%. I checked at the bank and said they can't say exactly, but I don't know why they gave me 1.4% 13 months ago. But it's now.
Well, let me ask you this, Carmen, and we'll have to let you go. But how do you think the insurance company is able to run their company, pay this salesperson, and still pay you 5% when the bank can only get you 1.4%?
Yeah. Well, team of experts, you know.
Did they have a picture in the brochure? Are they all dressed real nicely, standing around a big table, glasses on?
It sure is a cloudy area, isn't it?
Well, Carmen, good luck to you, Carmen, and thank you very much for the call. We are a little bit behind here, Kevin, so let's talk about smart assets. And I just received my homeowner's insurance policy renewal notice. You say this is a good time for me to review that.
Yes, even though a lot of people say, well, storm season or the flooding season is coming up, it's a good time to take a look at your homeowner's insurance. The problem, of course, is that it's a good idea, but by the time you actually get a hold of your agent and evaluate the policy, the storm season's come and gone because they're busy doing other things like, you know, helping people set up claims, et cetera. You should probably check your homeowner's insurance policy now if you can't remember the last time you've checked it. The National Weather Service said that last week, in a 24-hour period, there were 312 tornadoes counted in the United States. Those storms will end up costing homeowners insurance companies money, which may lead to a rise in premiums in your part. That's the bad news. The good news is Wisconsin residents pay less for homeowners insurance on average than just about every other state. The average premium payment for a homeowners insurance policy in Wisconsin in 2008 was about $500, and that's the fifth lowest out of the 50 states. because it's relatively inexpensive, you can evaluate it and maybe get some more coverage that you can afford but don't know even that you need. Once you look through what the policy actually covers right now, you may get some unpleasant surprises.
Like what kinds of surprises?
Well, you might find out that some of the bad things that you are well aware of that can happen to your home aren't covered. Flood damage probably isn't covered. Backed up sewer is generally not covered by many policies. Even storms may or may not be covered. It depends on the type of damage done to your home and if the problem was because of a structural issue in the home rather than the actual storm. When we talked about the inflation, about $4 a gallon gas, that inflation is permeating every other good and service just about throughout the world's economy. And that may mean that the cost to replace your home, get it back up to new, is much more expensive than replacing the actual value of the home if you should need to rebuild some or all of it. So you definitely want to check on that. If you've purchased any large item like jewelry, or I know, Joy, you've been collecting furs quite a bit lately, and you actually have a new addition put onto your home for your furs. I haven't seen it yet, but I can see it
in
from
my
Google
diamonds.
Earth.
Yes.
In your diamonds, right?
Yes.
Which you're wearing right now. You might get an extra rider on that. You also, by saving some money on your homeowner's insurance policy, that may allow you to afford an umbrella liability policy, which is typically very inexpensive, maybe a couple $100 a year, but it covers so many of the things above and beyond what your homeowner's insurance policy may cover. And finally, many homeowner's insurance companies are using credit scores to determine in part what they charge people. And if the economy is really dinged up your financial situation, your credit score might be down and that might cause you to pay more as well.
Are there any ways that we can cut the cost of our homeowner's insurance?
Yeah, you definitely want to talk to your agent first. Raising the deductible, doubling it from, say, $500 to $1,000 can sometimes cut the premium cost 10 to 20%. If you combine it with your auto insurance and get that from the same company, you can also cut the homeowner's cost maybe 10 to 20%. You may want to check your CLU report, and there's a new service out that gives that this is the kind of the background, the credit score, if you will, of your home. Shows what claims have been made and paid off. And make sure that it's accurate, because if it is inaccurate, there may be something on there that is costing you money that it shouldn't. And we'll have a link up to where you can get that for free at our website, onyourmoney.com.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he is here with us for another edition of On Your Money. We'll get to more of your personal finance calls at 1-800-642-1234 in just a few minutes. You can also email a question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Well, have you done your shopping for Mother's Day yet? Mother's Day is this Sunday, and if you are looking for a smart gift for your mom, Kevin says you might want to think about a technological upgrade. So, Kevin, we have a hint as to what mom's going to get for Mother's Day.
Yes. Gonna get batteries for her garage door opener.
Yeah, there we go.
That's right.
Flashlight.
Well, 85 million Americans can legitimately call themselves mothers. That's about one quarter of the population. The National Retail Federation says that the average expenditure on Mother's Day gifts per mother is $140. That can obviously be flowers or maybe brunch or a nice hat or something like that, but there could be some better ways to spend that money. And I understand there are many mothers out there who are extremely technologically savvy, but not all of them are. And if your mother is one of those people who isn't quite up to speed with her computers, there are a few things that you might look to either get for her or do for her.
Like what?
Well, for the same amount of money, you may want to look at getting her an e-reader like the Kindle from Amazon. The base amount costs $139, and there's a new version coming out right now that is only $114 that runs small ads on the device while the book is being used. They also have audiobooks they've added to it, and coming soon, there's going to be an agreement where you can actually borrow ebooks from 11,000 libraries throughout the country through your Kindle e-reader. And you do have to get that at Amazon.com, and they have some specials on right now where you get a gift card back for it. You may also like the Nook from Barnes & Noble for about the same price. They also have a color version of this. It's about $250 that has features that basically turn it into almost a tablet PC or a laptop PC. And again, for $250 plus getting the e-reader portion of it, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, so remind me, the $114 model is going to, we're going to see ads for stuff on our...
Small ads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ways to reduce your taxes, et cetera, legally avoid having to pay the IRS.
I love the thought of a Kindle. What about people who have a little bit more money to spend?
Well, then break the bank, get everybody's money together, and give your mother the gift that she will definitely not buy for herself, and that's an iPad. It's about $499 is a starting feature for that. It obviously has, for twice the price of a nice ebook, it's got way more than twice the features and applications. It's extremely easy to use, extremely enjoyable. And the best part about getting your mother an iPad is if she says, no, I just don't like it, you get to take it back, and then you've got a legitimate excuse to have one for yourself.
I was going to say, these sounds like great gifts for ourselves. What if we, though, have more time than money to spend?
Well, if she's close enough for driving distance, she'll be glad to see you. Show up and say, Mom, I'm going to clean up your PC for you. I'm going to run some antivirus software, put some spam blocker in, if you will, download all the updates from Windows or whatever, which she probably hasn't done for a while, increase her privacy settings, maybe on her Facebook page, if she might be putting information about herself or you out to the world that you just would, she and you would assume wasn't out there. And finally, this is a nice free thing to do. It just takes a little bit of time and effort. Put Skype on your mom's computer, S-K-Y-P-E, and that'll allow her to easily have video conferences if she has a small camera with the relatives and pop up on your screen and be able to look at you and see you or the grandkids or whomever. And if you just really want to have a few moments with your mom, tell her you're going to come over and say, Mom, I'm going to come over. Let's look at my baby pictures together, and you can go on all about the miracle of my birth and how happy you were and everything.
That's the very good ideas, Kevin. I want to know, are you Facebook friends with your mom?
I believe that, much like all the internet, Facebook is just a fad. And
it's not going to last.
Therefore, I don't like to defriend or unfriend or block any users. And so I'm still getting around to establishing a Facebook account. I'm very self-aware, and I know that once I set that up, I'm pretty much gone down a rabbit hole that from which I'll never return. So I'm still actually updating my GeoCities page right now, and so once I'm done with that, I'll start looking at Facebook.
Yeah, maybe your mom can give you some tips on that, Kevin. Mm-hmm. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, and we have time for your personal finance question now at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Better yet, send the email to onyourmoney@WPR.org. And our next caller is Patty in Menominee Falls. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I have a question regarding doing taxes yourself, and I don't want to take away your job, Kevin, but as far as getting what would be the best way to learn how to prepare taxes, what I need to be able to school myself with, and what would be the best program out there, or class, or what may you?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Who has done your taxes right now?
We've had accountants do our taxes.
Okay, I have an accountant do my taxes, and I don't do taxes for people.
You don't. Okay.
Nope. I would actually recommend, it depends on how much you want to know about strategies versus actually just getting the taxes done and doing it correctly. If you want to know about just get strategies and the way that the tax code and the forms all work, you could actually, one of the nice ways to do that is become a volunteer. And the IRS and ARP, I think somebody else, they offer classes where they train people to help give you free tax advice to people who need it. Usually older people or low income, they need help, but they can't afford a CPA.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to know that. Otherwise, you know, TurboTax is ubiquitous. H&R Block also has one for about $50 or so. They ask you all the questions digitally.
H&R Block?
Yeah, not the H&R Block, the service, but actually H&R Block has software that you can use yourself and go through it and prepare it yourself. Okay. But TurboTax is usually the vanguard of tax software.
Okay, yeah, because right now, as far as when we had an accountant, well, our our situation changed, so it's like, and tax, getting it done is getting higher and higher. So it's like, okay, what can I do to, you know, turn this around where I could benefit myself and understand actually what, you know, how to figure it out. But, I mean, if I can't figure it out, I'll definitely have to go somewhere.
Right. Hey, Patty, yep. Before you go, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Are you, whether or not, I'm not sure you're a mom or not, but would you like a Kindle or an iPad for Mother's Day?
I would definitely like an iPad. I'm above 50, so I actually saw a couple of younger kids having that, and I'm like, what the heck is that? And then they kind of walked me through it, and I'm like, you know what, that is a really pretty cool thing to have, because they actually can use it for everything.
Yeah,
and it's not just a phone. I mean, you can use it for a phone, but I think only certain people that you can call on. Is that the way I understand it? I'm not sure.
You can use the iPad as a phone, can't you, Kevin?
You can use it for just about everything. We actually thinking about getting one because our dining room table is a little wobbly, and the new thinner iPad is the perfect thickness just to prop it up just to keep it stable. So that's what we're looking at.
But I didn't mean to interrupt the tax talk.
Okay.
Are you set with that, Patty?
Yes, I'm pretty good. I guess my most important thing was just to figure out. I know it's probably not the greatest thing to do, but I'm just trying to be more diversified in many things that I do. So that'd be another thing I can scratch off my bucket list.
Kevin, yeah, I mean that's a smart thing to do. Maybe wanting to know how to do your own taxes. Why not?
It is, and a good CPA or tax preparer is definitely worth his or her cost. The question is the cost worth it to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, many of them are specializing more and more than just saying, well, here, do your taxes, here's what you owe, or you might want to do this. And because software is taking kind of the low end of the question, they really need to focus on planning and advising more to really draw the benefit out. But by the same token, because they then know more, they have to charge more. So it can get fairly expensive. In my case, it's worth it, but I can't say that's true for everyone.
Patty, thanks a lot. And I hope you get an iPad for Mother's Day. Bob in Madison is with us. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
Morning.
Back to bonds. Would you have any comment on bonds from Puerto Rico? It's my understanding that they are tax-exempt in the state of Wisconsin.
Yep.
Wisconsin.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't detect a Puerto Rican accent, I got more of a Wisconsin accent there. So, yeah, those are good bonds to look at, Bob, if you are a Wisconsin resident and you do you pay more taxes than you want on your income-earning investments. And you can even find bonds from Puerto Rico that are not only exempt from state and federal taxation for Wisconsin residents, but they can also be insured. The question is how long do you have to go? What is the yield versus what you would get on a taxable investment or a treasury bond or an FDIC-insured CD? And then are you putting too much money into those so that if something happens to the bond or the issuer or even interest rates or taxes, you've hurt your greater financial picture? I definitely don't mind those if they make up a small portion of your overall investment portfolio.
If you have to sell, what is a normal commission? You probably take a beating if you have to sell.
Actually, I'm not worried about the commission, although that you know, it can maybe be 1 or 2% of the value of the bond, depending on the size of the bond and how thinly or thickly it's traded. What I'm more worried about is if people become concerned about rising interest rates or interest rates do rise, that will generally hurt the value of those bonds, like all other bonds. And when it does happen, the longer the bond is until maturity, the more it's going to hurt it. So I would be more cautious about selling it in a bad market than I would be about the cost that you'll pay to sell it. It's not good for trading. It's something you should plan on buying and holding if you do get into it.
Thanks very much, Bob, and good luck to you. I think we have time for one more. Doug in Randolph. Hello, Doug.
Hello. Yeah, a quick question is, I'm about 5 years or less to retirement. My financial advisor just showed up, and I asked him to lower my risk, and he talked me into putting another $10,000 into a REIT. So I don't know if that's a good move or not.
And we talked about REITs last week. Remind us, Kevin?
Yeah, Real Estate Income Trust. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think real estate is low risk?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, it doesn't mean it's bad. As a matter of fact, it probably has a pretty good yield to it. It might even diversify your portfolio against your other type of investments. But real estate investment trusts are predicated on the income flowing from real estate, usually in the form of rent. And so if rents drop off, that makes it risky. It doesn't make it bad. It just means it might be more risk than what you were, what you thought you were getting.
Right. Well, he took it out of American funds and put it into a REIT.
Yeah. Did he put it into the American funds originally?
No, that was something I had before he took over my account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-oh, I hear some.
Yeah, luckily we're almost out of time,
yes.
So I can't go off on a rant here. I don't think it's the end of the world that it's in the REIT. It's not as safe as a CD or a treasury, put it that way. That could mean it's better because it probably pays more than a CD or a treasury does, but it's just not a safe investment per se.
All right, Doug, I hope that helps. We have time for the website of the week now, Kevin.
Yep. If you are going to take a home inventory, you could do worse than go to knowyourstuff.org. That's the Insurance Information Institute's free website. Give you a listing of where you can put down everything that has value, track it not only for insurance purposes, but for estate purposes as well. Knowyourstuff.org, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds very good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He will be back with us next week, every Tuesday, or just about every Tuesday between 8 and 9 for On Your Money. A reminder that tomorrow at this time, we will talk about preparing the first spring foods of the season, like asparagus and rhubarb, watercress, even dandelions. We'll talk about preparing those seasonal local foods tomorrow between 8 and 9 here on the Ideas Network, when it is One Day Wednesday, a day when we are going to try to raise a week's worth of pledges in just one day. I hope you'll join us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.